thank you so much for coming along to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
That's not a problem. So most people will know you for, actually, most people in the UK will know you for your boxing career, but you're also, you've been on many a TV programme. We'll come into that, by the way. And those further afield will now know you for your wrestling career, but I want to go right back to the beginning.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
How and why did you begin boxing?
Oh, so I was going to say, I'm bad at so many things. Right? I'm bad at so many things. You know some of them. If anybody saw me on Strictly Come Dancing, I got knocked out on week 3. I got beat by Ainsley Harriet. Mr. Ready Steady Cook himself kicked me out of the competition. So I'm not the best dancer. I can't do. There's a million things I cannot do. I cannot put a shelf up in my own house. That gets done for me. I leverage.
Taught well.
Thank you so much. But what I could do, there was two things I was good at growing up. I was good at sport. Any sport. I was that annoying kid that could pick up a badminton racket in like year 2 in PE and beat the teacher without never knowing what a shuttlecock was. And I was clever at school, believe it or not. I was really intelligent. I got school. I liked winning, liked being the best, and liked being the best in the class. And so growing up, I swam at a national level. I played football for Norwich until under 14s. I was captain of Norwich, captain of my county, captain of Suffolk. I was very talented at sport. As I said, very bad. I was so bad at doing the washing up.
Was that not intentional?
Well, probably. Probably. So I was quite smart growing up. Make a bad cup of tea once, never make it again, right? But I used to be like, I remember that we once had like silver fish in the cupboard because I didn't wash up properly. And I just put it in and in the bottom bowl got like just dirty.
Dysentery.
Yeah. So I never had to do that, which is great. But yeah, at 12 years old, it's quite a funny story, I think. 12 years old, two of my best friends had a fight at school in year 7. Played football. Every lunchtime, we played football. It was life to us. And I was in the final. I was good football. I was in the final playing single cuppies. And Adam Deacon and Aaron Cooper were battling it out in the semi-final to play me in the final. Adam Deacon was big. He was cool. All the girls, big as in like, not like obese, like big as in like he was quite taller than everybody else. He was cool, good looking lad, had cool hair, looked a bit like a Backstreet Boy.
Back in the day.
All the girls fancied him. Aaron Cooper, a geek, a nerd, small, skinny, scrawny, wore a backwards cap, and he used to play football with his backpack on. He'd play football with his backpack on.
Why?
Because he's a nerd. He's Aaron Cooper. He's a geek. So everyone put their bags in the goal. He used to wear like really strapped tight to his arms. And then anyway, Deacon was doing all the skill, a couple of quick turns, done a quick turn, took a shot. The ball deflected off Aaron's knee, flew into the top corner. So Aaron's ran off winning. He won. Deacon had the ump about it. He didn't like it. He goes over to him and pushes him. Deacon, big, strong, cool, good-looking lad. Pushes Cooper, he went flying. Backwards roll, hat came off.
Oh, with the backpack and
backpack
everything.
Backpack on, little crash at me. And he gets up and goes, don't do that, that's not very nice. Deacon gets him, pushes him again, he goes flying. This time, his bag opened, his lunch, so we never ate lunch at lunch, we'd always play football. So like in registration for the afternoon, we'd quickly have our lunch, have like a little moldy pear or something. And this time, Aaron's bag opened and the lunchbox opened up and there was his birthday coming up and the birthday cards came out of his bag. He took his bag off. He put the cards back in his bag, zipped off, put his bag back, walked to the Deacon with his hands up, right? Everyone's going, oh, fight. Deacon's gone, come on then. They're both squared up and everyone thought Deacon was going to win. The big, cool, good-looking one was going to win. Cooper went, bam, 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 bam. Threw these mad Bruce Lee punches. 20 seconds later, Deacon's on the floor crying his eyes out. Aaron won. Aaron. In my head, we lifted him up on the shoulders, but that's a lie. We didn't do that, but that's how to make the story.
Why let the truth get in the way? Yeah, of course.
So we put him up and then... Then the red arrows fly over there. But Cooper won and the bell gone. The bell went, everyone's gone in. And I was flabbergasted. I went, Deacon, I said, Aaron, I said, how'd you learn to do that? He said, I'll go boxing club. So I was 12, but I had no idea there's a boxing club in town. I said, well, can I go? And this is a Wednesday. He said, can I go? He said, yeah, it's on tonight. He said, but I go to the advanced class. I've been going for like a year. Had no idea. One of my best mates. He said, so 6 till 7 is beginner. 7 till 8:30 or 9 is advanced. I said, well, I want to go. He said, well, you can come. So I got a deacon. I didn't want to go by myself. So deacon's on the floor, wiping the tears out of his eyes. I went, deacon, I went, hey, Aaron only won because he goes boxing club.
He sold it to him.
I said, I said, like, what we should do, go tonight, get really good, and you can fight him tomorrow, then you'll win. He went, oh, I don't know, I'm not too sure, wiping the tears from his eyes. I said, mate, if you did, all the girls are going to fancy you again. He went, really? Said, yeah, definitely. Went, okay, then. So that night, the bell went 3:30. Aaron said to me, take a gum shield, go get a gum shield. So I got my bicycle, bike tire, mum, going out, because I didn't tell her, mum, going out, all right, be back or whatever. Got my bike, called around for Deacon, gave him a seater, biked to the thingy. On the way, there's a sports shop called Jeweler Sports, which is like a little private sports shop. I walked in, I bought an orange gum shield for 50p. I had no idea you had to mold it to your mouth in hot water. So I walked to the boxing gym with an orange gum shield. I walked into the gym, took it out, through the caseway. I'm biking down to the boxing gym with an orange gum shield in my mouth. Walked in, big, like, fat geezer called John was in charge of the AAA Boxing Supremo. He was like the head coach. And I said, oh, I just want to box. I want to fight. You know, can we go in? And I walked in the gym and I fell in love. And I had no idea if I was going to be any good or not. I thought I would because I was good at sport and it's a sport. But if I was no good, and that was where I was, that was, do you know, the weirdest thing, the first time in my entire life I felt at home. I felt like I found a place where I could call home. And I walked in the gym and thankfully I loved it and I was really good. I picked up really quick. Deacon went, he hated it, never went back. And then, that's how I got into boxing.
Interesting. There's like a ton of things that I want to unpack inside of that, but I'm conscious of time, so I'm going to pick certain things out. First things first, I love an underdog, so I'm glad that Cooper won.
Yeah.
What was it about him winning the fight that made you want to do it?
He was a small, scrawny little geek. Deacon, he was an underdog.
Yeah.
He was an underdog, and I guess I've always liked the underdog as well. We do in Britain. And he just baffled me. He was so strong. He was so fast. He was so like, he beat Deacon up. Deacon was big and cool and good looking. All the girls fancied him. Aaron was a scrawny little geek. Did you hear the backwards cap story?
Did you hear? Backwards cap and a backpack. That makes me love him all the more. I like the fact that he was willing to stand out.
He put his cards back in his bag thinking, these can't get wet. It was February. These can't get wet on the wet ground. That guy doesn't win fights. But he smashed Deacon. So I was so impressed.
So do we have him to thank for the fact that at some point in your life you got really, really good at it?
Do you know what?
you ever thanked him?
We've been trying to get for years. Like, it's cute. He was really talented, but very lazy. And he was very talented and he used to lose a lot of fights and split decisions because he used to, what I call, toss it off in the gym. He wouldn't train hard. And I couldn't work out why he wouldn't train because he was so talented. We had some really good spars. He was really good. He could have been really good, but listen, like, talent, like, hard work always beats talent when talent doesn't work hard.
Would you agree with that in every area of life?
100%. 100%. There's not an aspect where it doesn't. Like, you can be the best. I often talk about, I used to love winning fights I wasn't supposed to win. Mm-hmm. Because hard work beats anything. Hard work, like, I often say, I was never at an elite level. I was never the biggest, never the strongest, never the hardest puncher or the fastest. Don't get me wrong, I was an athlete. I was good at everything. But my superpower was you would not outwork me. I'd out-hustle you. And the little thing you said to my head was like, whoever I boxed, I'd take them through the trenches and drown them in the mud. That's my little thing.
Like the actual phrase.
I love it. I would make them work at such an uncomfortable pace that they couldn't live with me. And eventually, I'll grind them down, and usually I did. So, yeah, I think hard work beats everything. And I think, don't get me wrong, I'd love to have like Mike Tyson knockout, natural, like animalistic power, but hard work beats it. You know, that was my superpower, I believe.
Nice. So there's still more things that I want to unpack just even from that first thing, which means all of my questions that I pre-prepared, so everyone knows that I prepared, I'm a bit of a geek, they will go out of the window. So if they do, I'm pre-warning you. There'll be a round 2 for this. Okay. So Two things. First one, you said you didn't tell your mum. Why didn't you tell your mum?
Because she'd say no. I'm my mum's little boy. I got, so I grew up in a house full of women, mum and four sisters, no father figure around, no male influence around. My granddad was quite, wasn't actually, he passed away in 2005 or 73. He wasn't that old, but he was from the generation where we started smoking at 11.
Yeah.
Because that's what they did. And we grew up, you know, post-war Britain, must have been brutal, right? Mm. In a small town, lower South East Anglia. Went to work in Manchester for many, many years. Went back to lower South, incidentally. This is like, no dog, you hear the old school stories. My granddad, my nan and my granddad lived in lower South. And then he said, we're selling a house, going to Manchester, because that's where the work is. There's no work there because there's no industry. And my nanny obviously had to go, and they went. And then he was like, I think they're there for like 7 or 11 years, a long time. My uncle was born there. And then he said, oh, Janet, he said, we're going back. Okay.
Up sticks and move.
And then they bought the exact same house I left. They bought the exact same house. To Kingston Close in Lowestoft, Pegfield. Yeah. Yeah, but that's one of those weird old stories. Those things kind of tend to happen, right?
There's a funny more.
I heard a funny story recently that like a man didn't see a banana till he's like 10 years old.
So for those people who are listening thinking, what the hell is that? That's my dad, who is now 87, the legend that is Charlie, who tells many a story. Each story takes at least an hour. And if we've heard once, we've heard a million times how he didn't see a banana till he was 10 years of age, and me and my twin had to share it. So yeah, I'll interview my dad one day. You still haven't answered me the question, though.
What's the question? Oh, and also, we've both discovered recently, we're pretty sure we've both got ADHD.
Yes.
So this podcast could
can't
go anywhere.
Help anyone.
Could go anywhere. So if you're struggling to follow along, I apologise.
That's just quite normal with our conversation. So I'm going to bring you back to, you were telling us granddad was the father figure, but the reason you didn't tell mum was you grew up in a house full of women.
That's right.
I'm on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I should have said no, I guess, and because I'm her little boy.
So don't ask for permission, beg for forgiveness.
100%. And I used to lie. I used to come home from training and say, so she found out. I was going, in my head, I was going for 6 months. I wasn't. It's probably four sessions, right? Like in my head, I was there for ages. I was like a sneaky little ninja and she had no idea. She obviously had no idea. I was quite good, right? And then I could bounce quite hard as a kid. And I remember I used to come home from training with blood on my vest. Then what I used to do, I used to bike to training. And I would, when I had blood on my vest from either my blood or their blood from sparring, what I would do, this is really weird, I'd fall off my bike. And for those listening, I'm doing the rabbit ears fall, right? I'd fall off my bike and get my elbow on the gravel and elbow, like just scrape the skin off my elbow, get my vest and mop up the blood to masquerade the blood from the nosebleed from my elbow. So, oh, mum, I fell off my bike. She must have thought I was an idiot. She must have thought, like, you're 13, you can't ride a bicycle. So,
do you think she knew really?
She knew when I just chucked my clothes in the washing machine in a dirty washing basket, and then she found that. She found the now molded, when I figured out how to do it, the now molded gum shield in the pocket. The first time I said I had rugby at school, we had to have one. And the second time it was like, Mum, come on, I'm not an idiot. Where are you going? 3 nights a week. Mum, go boxing. Like, that's it. That's it.
She told you no more.
She told me no more. And she saw how upset I was. Because she, you know, I was a little boy, little soldier, still am. And, she banned me from going for like a week, and then I got really upset. I said, Mum, please just come down and see. It's not a underworld of crooks like you think it is. They're nice, genuine, like hardworking people. 2-3 coaches who give up their time 3 nights a week to train young boys. There's no girls back then to train young boys. And so she came down, she met John, she met Spud, she met Willie, the 3 coaches. I said, random.
It sounds like
John,
the start
Spud
of a joke.
And Willie. John, Spud and Willie. And she came and they like assured her, like, this is a safe, nice environment. She was there for a little bit and she said, listen, she said to me, you can do it, but be good. And I was like, okay. Annoyingly, in boxing, one of the one sport in the world where the better you get, the harder it gets. Like, you get better, you got to fight better people and get hit. I'd come home from training and I'd say, oh, Mum, the coach said to me that if I train really hard, I could be the best boxer they've ever seen. complete lies. I just wanted her to know that like I was training hard.
I'm doing good.
And yeah, and actually, luckily I was.
Which leads me to the third part of that one story, which was you said everything you do, you have to win at. Is that still the case?
Do you know what? Honestly, no, not really. I've changed. Like I've changed. I had to retire from boxing number 4 years ago. And one of the hardest things was leaving some aspects of me in the past. And you've helped me with that a lot. So thank you, Tony, for that very much. I mean that sincerely. Like I've really struggled with leaving parts of me which have always been a part of me in the past. I haven't won everything. I.e., it sounds really violent, but like I used to love hurting people. The most amazing people say the most amazing thing in boxing when you've had a really, really, really hard fight and then really close fight, then when you win, like that feeling is, I mean, if you could bottle that and sell it, you'd be a kajillionaire. The second best feeling is when you hit somebody and you hear their like, this sounds really violent, the septum crunch under your knuckle.
Ew.
And you see the first bit of blood trickle from the nose or see the knee wobble. To a boxer, that's porn. that's what you do it for. And it's that bit of I used to really like hurting people. I used to like hurting people. When the bell would go, I'd become a different person. Then the bell would end and then I'm back to being a respectful person. And I never wished harm upon my opponent, like serious harm. I wanted to win the fight no matter what, but I never wished serious harm on my opponents. And it's weird having that, like, not having that outlet when I had to retire. I don't get to do that anymore. I just love going to the gym, sparring, and just beating the fuck out of someone. Because growing up, I got battered all the time in sparring. Always spar people that are bigger than me. She spar men as a boy. I got fucking levered. So can I swear on this one?
It's my podcast. What a stupid question.
What a silly question.
It's punctuation where I come from.
So what's the question?
Do you always still have to win?
No. Actually, I've learned there are some parts of me now that if I prefer parts of me that I prefer, like the non boxing me. I've relaxed. I've mellowed a lot. I've calmed down. I haven't got to win all the time, and I guess the reason why. And I'm going to get deep. This is what we do. ADHD. That's what we do. Thanks, Sophie King, for diagnosing me. By the way. what was I saying?
You said you're going to get deep.
Going to get deep. Boxer, head punches, CTE. So I guess growing up as a kid, I was raised by my mum. She's my hero. She had five kids. She worked two, three jobs. My dad was not in the picture. That's a very nice way of saying he was a shit dad and a terrible husband. Very impressive man. And somebody that I would love to have got to know as a man. Because obviously when you're growing up, you think your parents are perfect. You think they're great, right? Well, I did. I thought my mum was the most... And I thought my... And but when you get to a certain point, I got to 30 and I realised that they're just people. They're fallible. They make mistakes.
Yep.
My dad made some banging mistakes. Or maybe he didn't. I don't know. That's the thing. I'd love to spoke to him about some of the decisions he made in his life. Were there mistakes? Why'd you do it? I think, I didn't know the man, so I don't know what he would have done. But I get to a point in my life and I'm far from perfect. And I kind of half, I don't, you know, I don't want to go into really what he did, but we weren't close at all. But I guess growing up, my mum was so busy raising five kids, working, providing a roof over her head. Mm-hmm. Very little or no support from my dad. My dad wasn't in the picture. He'd swan in his D-Reg Mercedes, which was the bollocks back then, like shiny, the music, he had like Nigerian beads in the car. And I thought he was the coolest man in the world. He'd turn up in his Nigerian outfit, his hat and his Nigerian clobber. And then it was very loud, unbelievably charismatic, extremely charming. All the women fancied him, all the men thought he was so cool, really muscular. I remember when he was at home, I remember he used to eat his Cocoa Pops and I'd look at him. We didn't spend a lot of time together. Like when he was around, I thought he was just mesmerised by this man. I grew up in Lowestoft, one of the most whitest, like underprivileged places in the country, poorest people in the country, like you know, ignored places in the country. And so I'd see black people and go, well, I see my dad. Black people didn't, he went to Lowestoft in 1979. He was the first black person that people literally had ever seen. my mom had ever seen, my family had ever seen. My nan and granddad let my mom go out with him because her last boyfriend was a raging lunatic. And for even an African, it's got to be better than him. Literally what they thought. They were just, they're not ignorant, right? They're not. Yeah. God, no, I've gone off another track. What am I saying? So my dad was very, very, very impressive. I'd want to copy him how he ate his Cocoa Pops. And basically, I wanted him to love me, essentially. I wanted my dad to love me, and he was never around. And my mum is a superwoman, but she spread her time around 5 children, all at one point under the age of 10 years old, 10 years between us all, worked, as a psychiatric nurse, as a carer. Eventually, she got a job as a dinner lady because at one point in our school, there's 3 of us at school. So she would be a carer in the morning, she'd be a carer at night time for old people. And then we'd all kind of have to like look after each other and help each other and stuff and make our lunch and dinner. And then just to spend time with us, she'd got a job as a dinner lady. So because at school, there'd always be 3 of us at that school, which I thought like was really, really sweet. Annoying when I was there. Mom, I want to flirt with that girl in the bike sheds. But mom, you crap in my style, mom.
But it's, let's be honest.
I'm wanting it. No, I can't say it.
No, don't do it.
And essentially, I guess I used to act up at school. I used to play up. Typical behavior. I wanted to get attention because I never really got any. My dad was never around. Didn't give a fuck about me. I wanted him to love me. My mum did her absolute best, but she couldn't spread herself between her jobs, keeping a roof over her head, keeping us fed, and my other 4 sisters. So I guess I could have went down a bad route and like being really naughty to get that attention, or I guess I wanted to win everything to get attention from teachers, my name in the newspaper, attention from whoever to whoever. So that's why I had to excel everything, because people, you know, I thought it was love. People giving me attention, I thought that was love that I was missing. So and if my mom listens to this, she'll be upset because she did the most amazing job. The most amazing job. But yeah, I guess looking back, it took me to get to 30 years old to realize that why did I crave attention from women, from this, from that, from my agents? Like when things go wrong, the phone stops calling and I used to get really pissed off while my agents calling me with opportunities because I needed this attention, because going back from my childhood, I didn't get it enough as much as I wanted. I wasn't loved. I didn't feel like I was loved enough, you know, so. This is deep.
You knew the podcast was going to go this way. Do you think that led to you needing the kind of recognition in, because you must have had a lot of recognition because you were very successful as both an amateur and a professional boxer. So, you know, you move quite quickly. Do you think that's what it was? The more you got, the more you needed?
Yeah, you said to me actually a couple of weeks ago, you said to me, I need to be needed and I want to be wanted. And I was like, never heard it before. And I was like, oh. And yes, as I said, I could have went down numerous different avenues. I could have done different things. Luckily, I channeled it in sport and being successful. There's much worse things I could have done. But ultimately, wherever it was, I had to win. I had to be a winner. And then whether it's for attention, or which I think it was now looking back and the work I've done on myself, or other reasons, I wanted to win ultimately. And winning success breeds success. When you win, you want to win more. I used to hate losing. So I genuinely forgot the question you asked me just now.
No, you've answered it. That's fine. I'll keep you on the straight and narrow with it, because you were very successful. You were, you know, junior champion, world champion, moved to the Olympics at the age of what? How old were you?
23.
So at 23, you won an Olympic medal. Is that your biggest achievement?
It is, but not because of the medal itself. It was because everything around it. Yeah, the journey I got to. I mean, it took me 8 years, genuinely 8 years, to look at my Olympic medal. And yeah, till 2020 during lockdown, when I had, you know, stuck home for 6 months like everybody else in the country, for me to look at my medal and be proud. Actually, I was very bitter for a long time. Very resentful that I didn't. And I used to say this. I'm not going to say this now because I'm almost over it. I used to say, because I didn't win my gold medal. It's called my gold medal because it should have been around my neck in my trophy cabinet at home. But yeah, very bitter I didn't get what I believe I deserved more than anybody else. who's ever lived. Generally, I used to be, yeah, I kind of became a very bitter, resentful person. The person that I'm not.
Are we all right to go there as to why?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so why the bitterness? Because, you know, a lot of people will just have seen you won a gold, you won a bronze medal and been, you know, oh, well done you, but they don't know all of the surroundings behind it. So why do you feel like the gold should have been yours and what led to...
It's a long story, but I'll try to like focus on the main points, and just people listening have to kind of just appreciate there's way more. When I say there's...
It's the abridged version.
Yeah, when I say dislocated shoulder, people go, oh, that sounds nasty. But what that means is like surgery. It means just going to the operating theatre, being put to sleep again, thinking, like having to sign a disclaimer, I might die. All these silly little things, like the not silly things, having the rehab, the pain, falling down the stairs when we are 3 days post shoulder surgery. But in short, why was I resentful? I should have qualified in 2011, the year before the Olympics, 8 months before. My shoulder came out in a fight. It got popped out by the person I was boxing. I had a whole surgery, had to kind of rehab back really quick. So much so that in a fight years later in the pros, it came out again. I, long story short, I finally qualified in Trabzon at the second attempt, which that in itself, like I do a bit of public speaking now. Big thing to you.
Good thing to have, haven't you? Toolkit.
Is. I'll talk about that more later. And the help that you've given me in the tutelage and the guidance. I've got a whole hour talk about just qualifying, not even the Olympics, that's another hour talk, but just qualifying, the ups and downs, the trials and tribulations that I suffered. I pulled back, I was 6 points down going into the last round to qualify for the Olympic Games. Some context behind that. In the previous 4 year Olympic cycle from Beijing to London, nobody had ever pulled back a 3 point deficit in elite international boxing. Nobody ever pulled back a 3 point deficit going into the last round. I was 6 points down. So I did that. That was amazing in itself. The reason why I was 6 points down is because the guy I was boxed to qualify was the guy that popped my shoulder out the year before. So I boxed him. I lost my head. I went back to that angry. Oh, as a kid, I was really angry as well. As a kid, look, I had a lot to be angry
just
about.
Just threw that in there at the end.
Yeah, I was a horrible and angry kid. So I went back to the little kid that wasn't loved in that fight, and I lost my head, and I managed to pull back this amazing, amazing comeback. And one of my talks is called Just One Punch, because I've won so many fights by just one punch, which, you know, it takes just one punch to change a whole life, for good and for bad, which I've suffered and been both sides of the coin. I beat him. I qualified after the most traumatic 18 months of the Olympic process. I finally qualified. I was finally there. I was about to achieve a dream. I was going to go to London, win the gold medal. And the Olympic gold medal in London as well was the only thing I really wanted to do in my life. Like most boxers become a boxer because they want to become a Ricky Hatton or Amir Khan or Andy Joshua, or Joe Calzaghe, Lennox Lewis, and win a world title as a pro. The pros never bothered me. I wasn't fussed by the pros. I genuinely handled my heart. If I'd have won an Olympic gold medal, there's a very, very, very high chance I'd have retired from boxing.
Wow.
Never boxed again, because it doesn't get better than that for me. Don't get me wrong. If the Oscar De La Hoya comes to me, Eddie Hearn comes to me, it's £10 million to turn pro. It'd have been hard to say no, but I've never done it for money. We grew up really poor, like single parent, 5 kids. I've never had money. Money, although it's nice to have, it's never been my driving force.
Yeah.
Like the Olympic gold medal, I could have done anything I wanted in my life after that, because I'd have done my one thing. Money would have come from other areas as well. So,
can I just ask, when did that, when was the goal set? Because it sounds like it was the pinnacle, the only thing, you know, the kind of turning pro, all of the rest of it came off the back of it. But
yeah. So I'm going to talk to you actually. You're going to come on my podcast at some point and we're going to talk about success. And I want to know what, like, I'm fascinated by I've heard you talk before when you do your presentations at Progressive, you talk about success. And I love the way you talk about it. For me, success was winning the Olympic gold medal. When did I think of it? When I was 3.5 years old. Linda Christie just won a gold medal in Barcelona in 1992. And I was literally 3.5. And I remember my mum well fancied him. As a thing for African fellas, obviously. And my sisters were a bit older than me. other than one, the other three older than me, they got what was going on. I remember being at home in a little house in Lowestoft, tiny little two up, two down, and watching the telly, a tiny little, but as big as that, right? Big as your phone screen. Yeah. But not as good picture. Had to like do the aerial, the tracking wasn't working.
It was a long time ago.
Mine too. And he won a gold medal, and I saw him, excited my mum and my family were. And he was cool, he was muscly, he had the big smile, the Union Jack behind his head. And I thought, I want to do that. I don't even know what that is, but I want to do that. And even before I started boxing, I thought I was going to be a legend. Even before, I used to write in my school books, year five, year six, Anthony Gogo, future legend. Didn't even know what I was going to do. But that was in my head. And then when I started boxing at 12 years old, my dream is being a footballer or a swimmer or anything else. Because as I said, didn't matter what I did. I just like to win. And then boxing appealed to me so much because I was angry. I was an angry boy, had a lot of frustration in me. And now looking back, I had a lot to be angry about.
Yeah.
And football was great, but people didn't want to win as much as me. Swimming was great, but it didn't take all the... Swimming was great because it was you... What I like about swimming, I started very young and I liked the discipline it instills.
Yeah.
Three times before school. I quit at 12 when I started boxing. So up until 7 to 12, I was going to swimming training before school, 2-3 days a week. After school, I was so... And I just love, because like, if you win or lost, it was down to you. And that's what I love about... And for football, why I struggle with football, I used to want to win more than my teammates.
Yeah.
We could be winning 3-0 and concede a goal, I'll be distraught.
Oh, your anger would come out.
And then Kevin Ricks, the manager, said to me, he said, mate, we're still winning. The manager? I'm like, obviously he's a grown man and he had like real life problems. I was 10, 11, 12.
That was your world.
It was my wife. What do you mean we're still winning? We conceded a goal. And I used to, boxing is down to you also, to a degree, there's subjective with the judges. Where was I going with this one?
That's in your head. I can't help you with that one.
I was making a point. But what was the point I was trying to make? What was the question you asked me? I'll get back to it.
I can't even remember what I asked you. This is why we should not do a podcast together.
We need someone to dictate the play.
No, do you know what it is? It's because I've gone off script. It's because I'm taking questions from the things that you're saying rather than the pre-planned stuff, which is the way a podcast always sounds best.
100%. Basically, future legend. I want to be the best. Olympics. Linford Christie.
Therefore, when you were 12, everything else went by the wayside.
Yeah,
swimming,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, well done. So,
thanks. I got there in the end.
From a long time, my only goal was Olympic Games. Going back to the original question, I just qualified. We had 8 weeks before my first fight at the Olympics, and we had a week off at home with the families, and it was fantastic. And then we went back to Sheffield with the GB, with the Great Britain boxing team trained. Went to Sheffield on Monday. We trained on a Monday night. On a Tuesday morning, we'd go to the track, which is like most people would drive. I'd jog down. I was a geek. I was like, I wanted it so bad. I'd jog down to the track and I would do the run. I'd jog back, stretch back at the, in our little flats rather than on the track because, I used to, whatever.
You're doing it all or nothing.
Yeah, I'd give it my all. Looking back now, I overtrained. I got a lot of injuries because I overtrained. I just wanted it so much. I wish I knew now what I knew then, but
you wish you knew then what you knew now.
You know what I mean. That's what I said, right? So, thanks so much. Wish I knew. I'm gonna fuck up again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So basically, and I got back, and I was stretching in the front room of the little flat, and I got a phone call from Joanne. At 8:21 on a Tuesday morning, I thought, that's weird. I answered the phone. I said, hello. She went, Annie, get back home now. Mum's about to die. And my mum is the strongest woman in the world. I'd barely ever seen her cry. And she suffered a brain aneurysm. And life just stopped. She went, Annie, get. And I said, well. And so I got some stuff, jumped in my car, drove back the 4 hours back to Lowestoft, have no recollection how I got home. One of those ones, have no recollection. I remember my wife's a teacher. She was teaching the class. I remember my girlfriend back then. I remember I was calling her and I couldn't get through. So I remember I was calling and calling and calling until I couldn't get through. Anyway, so I got the James Paget Hospital in Gorston, Norfolk. And I got in and I walked in the door and my two of my sisters, one sister was in Liverpool, West Indian University, one was in Brisbane, Australia. So I walked in and my nan, who I'd never seen cry because she's my nan, and my two sisters threw their arms around me like I was going to save the day. And that's a really weird feeling. And we all hugged and my mum was, I could see her like on the bed all masked up. And that's a really weird feeling when you see someone like that who's so strong and resolute and powerful look helpless. And I thought, it's just strange. And then the doctor came over to me, young doctor. He said to me, are you Mr. Ogogo? And I said, yeah, I was. He said, you can come into my office. I went into his office and I'm my mum's next of kin. And he said to me, she had a big subarachnoid bleed in the back of her left side of her brain. He explained it to me. And he said, and this was a throwaway comment. He said, there's nothing else. We can't do anything else. The only place that could do something is Adam Brooks in Cambridge. You've got a special head unit. He said, but we've spoken to them and they've got no beds available. But anyway, he said, we've sent them the scans. They can't do anything. So I'm going to turn off the life support machine. And I mulled it over. And I said, I just kind of frowned and said, very politely, would you please mind sending her to Adam Brooks? He said, no, we can't because, as I've said, we've spoken to them. They've seen the scans and the reports. They can't do anything anyway. So we're going to have to turn off the life support machine. So I understand what you're saying, but would you mind just sending her to Adam Brooks, like, just in case, so they can actually see her? He said, he sighed and said, look, Mr. Gogo, no, because as I've said, the scans are bad. I asked again, I asked three times very politely. The fourth time, I don't know what I said, but I went back to that angry little 12-year-old boy. I don't know why I said, I don't know what happened because I saw red. He left the room and then he came back. It could have been a minute, it could have been 20. He said to me, we've been on the phone to him, a bed's just opened up. He said, we're going to send her, but please don't expect much because I said, thank you very much. I remember when he left, having to go, like I was boxing actually, yeah. Like I sat down in the corner, having to calm my breathing down, like in through your nose, out through your mouth. So I don't know what I said. I probably very passionately, should we say, asked me to send her. So we went away, he came back. They blew it out to the hospital. They even like do the siren, they just blew it out to the hospital. I jumped in my car and it was a day that England played Italy in the Euro 2012 European Championships. We lost on penalties, I think. And then I went, I don't know, I remember that. And then I was there for a month. I left once. So they got there, they operated on her immediately. I remember talking to the doctor, all my family went, Leanne came back from Australia, Carly came down from Adam Brooks, and they all had families and stuff. So I stayed. And Carly stayed for a little bit and she had to go and do university exams and stuff. And I was there. And I talking to the doctors and then she was having surgery and the doctor was saying to me, like, look, she's not very good. And I remember being in the ward, looking around the ward and it was like, everyone was old. Mum was 52 at the time. And I thought, she's young. She's not old. She's my mum. She's tough as fuck. At this point, I still lived at home. I was away in Sheffield Monday to Friday, back home for a weekend. And I'd come home with my suitcase, all my like dirty washing. And then she'd wash it all and she'd wash my hand wrap. She's my biggest fan. Her and my nan, my biggest fans. And then she'd wash my hand wraps. She used to hate washing my hand wraps. And then she'd make like a little pack lunch. And then, you know, she'd always tell me to like pull over in Lincolnshire on the way to Sheffield and eat sandwiches. I was like, oh, I'm going to pull over. And then I was probably a little mommy's boy still. And I was 23 and I thought I was a man, but I was a baby still. I was a baby that needed his mum, right? And then, anyway, so the one time I left, I forget what day it was, and the doctor said, look, you can't do anything, just go home. And they obviously knew I'd qualified for Olympic Games. By this point, I hadn't done anything. The Olympics could not have been any further from my mind. Mm. Before July, June 19th, it was the only thing on my mind. And then I went home, and then I had a phone call. At 2 a.m, I was asleep. My girlfriend's in bed next to me and my phone's ringing and I shit myself. I've squeezed her hand so hard. That's the case. I can't answer it. From Adam Brooks. I can't answer it. And I was 100% sure that was the phone call to say, like, your mum has just died. And she went, I got you. Just answer it. And I answered, I'm going to tingle, I was talking about it. And I answered it. And they said, Mr. Gogo, your mum has had a big buildup of pressure in the brain. We've got to do a very dangerous surgery now, like now. We need permission. It's very dangerous, letting you know. I said, just do the fucking surgery. Just do it. And they did that. I got my car, went back there, and I didn't leave. And then thankfully, she got through that surgery. There's another thing to worry about. After about a month, 3.5, 4 weeks, my sisters and my then girlfriend, now my wife, they guilted me. They said, look, you've got to do the Olympic Games. They said, if you don't do the Olympic Games, it's a cup of tea. Tony, you're making me feel upset.
I'm not making you feel anything.
You're meant to be my friend. They said, you got to do the Olympics. They said, mum will feel awful knowing that you pulled out for her. And they said, they guilted me. And I thought, fuck. I was like, and they were right, because my mum, I said, she's my biggest fan. And how do I pull out of Olympic Games? So I had a choice to make. Like, either stay over, because she's going to die. Right? We all think she's going to die. We're trying to be positive, but like, we all think she's going to die. And like, I stay over and I'm there for her. Or I go, then she dies, never see her again. Or in a small chance she does survive and I don't even win the games, that would have literally killed her, because she knows how much it meant to me. She still washed my hand wraps at this point. So I had the hardest decision I've ever made actually in my life, was to leave. And I've got a picture of me holding my mum's hand. Carly's giving her a cuddle. Carly's dyed ginger hair is in there, and I'm holding my mum's hand. Got a picture of it. Just me, so I literally thought that was the last time I'm going to hold her hand. And then went to Sheffield. And this is my life. Like, this is my life. Or was my life. I'm trying to change things now. Trying to speak good things into existence. But this is my life for a long time. We had 1 week of training left. 1 week left in Sheffield before going to London for Olympic Games. All the coaches knew what was going on with me. I've been away for a month. None of the lads knew what was going on. I got there on a Monday night. All the lads were already there. On the Tuesday, we had a family and friends day. So all the lads going, all the boys and girls going to London, got to invite their family and friends to watch them train. One last hurrah for the day. Obviously, all my family were either at home or in the hospital. My mum was by myself. I had my phone in my next of kin in my shorts pockets. So rather than wearing like boxing shorts with no shorts, I wore my Team GB tracksuit shorts with pockets, right? So in case they called, I'd stop the sparring onto the phone. And I sparred Fred Evans. And Fred Evans, unbelievable fighter he was. Traveller. So people that know boxing, travellers are very passionate, like, fight fans. All his family, his dad, his uncle, his brothers around the ring, whacking the ring like it was a real fight. I hadn't thrown a punch in a month. I hadn't even barely warmed up. I put some grease on my eyebrows, put my gloves on, my protector on. The bells come out. I've thrown a slow, sloppy jab. Fred slipped. Fred, who was super sharp, red hot, been training straight through, slipped it, body shot. He breaks my rib. And right now, I'll show you later. Right now, I'm not sure, you can touch it later. I've got he cracked and dislocated my rib. I've got a big lump here. Still, the bone never went back. And then I somehow got through the 4 rounds. I somehow got through the spar. I was numb to pain by this point. I'd lost weight. I was a big middleweight. Used to box 75 kilos. I was walking around at 72 kilograms, half a stone under my boxing weight. I used to have to try really hard to stay at 78 kilograms. I hadn't eaten anything in ages, hadn't trained, and I was just a gaunt mess. And I sat on a ring apron after the spar and just crouched. My rib was killing me. Breathing in air, my rib was like getting stabbed in the tummy. I had a dislocated shoulder, as I mentioned. It would come out later in a fight. That was smashed to bits. I had a broken rib. I had tears in both my Achilles tendons, which would keep me out of the ring for 2 years after the Olympics. And worst of all, I thought my mum was going to die. I'm never going to see her again. And that was my Olympics. That was my build-up. People say to me, oh, the Olympic Games must have been amazing. I just go, Olympic Games, during the Olympics, there's 2.5 weeks in Olympic Games. Boxing, I didn't go to the opening ceremony on a Friday night because I boxed on a Saturday. So the one thing I wanted to do is, the one thing you dream of, walk around that track with the we had a beautiful white and gold tracksuit with the flags, and like, I never got to do it, so I boxed for the next day, and my final fight was the day before the last day. So I was in the competition the whole 2.5 weeks. I crept out of the Olympic Village at midnight. I'd leave the room. The coaches would go to bed. I'd leave the room. I'd I drove my car and parked it at Wanstead, which is near Stratford. I'd get on the tube, midnight, 1 a.m. on the Central Line, get my car in Wanstead, drive up the M11 to Adam Brooks in Cambridge. I'd flirt the nurse to let me in because I was outside of visiting hours, and magically it worked. And I sit there and hold my mum's hand for a couple of hours, stroke her hair for a couple of hours, get back in my car, drive back to Wanstead. I'd wait till 5 in the morning till the tube's running again, get on a tube, get back to the Limbic Village and creep my way back in, sit in the bed, the alarm would go off, and then the day would start. I did that 2 times during the competition, and when I got beaten in the semi-final, I did it the day after. So 3 times in Olympic Games. That was my Olympic Games. So when people say, and then I got a really, really hard draw, I thought, so my proudest moment, so weaved into your original question ages ago, I boxed a Ukrainian in my second 5 Olympic Games, the reigning world champion. Nobody gave me a prayer when beating this guy. He was the bollocks. He punched so hard. He was the world number one, world champion. He was the diamond in the Ukrainian team that consisted of Lomachenko and Usyk. Any boxing fans know they're the 2 best boxers in the world right now. He was the star. Ivan Krytov was the man. He was his name. I boxed him and beat him in the most unbelievable fight there's ever been in the Olympic Games. That's not me being biased. Jim Neely, who covered 5 Olympics and like 5 Olympics, so many world championships, maybe 20 world championships. He said in his commentary, when I beat this guy, he said to me, "Oh my Lord, what an upset. That's to be one of the best performances by any British boxer around the ring. That's to be one of the best performances by any British boxer in any century around the ring. Fucking hell, I can't talk.
It's all right, start again.
I'm choked. Jim Neely, edit this. Jim Neely said, when I beat Ivan Krytov, and I've got these words pinned up in my garage at home in my gym, "Oh my Lord, what an upset. That's to be one of the best performances by any British boxer in any amateur boxing ring around the world in any century." Then Richie Riddle, who is a consultant GB boxing coach, also a commentator, he knew my mum's situation. He said, "Oh my God, I'm so proud of your son." Oh. He said, he'd done that for his mum. His dear mum is poorly going into these Olympic Games. He's done it for his... Fucking hell, Tony. Jesus, I don't cry. What the fuck's going on? He said he'd done it for his mum, his poor mum. So, Anthony, I'm proud of your son. Well done. And I've heard those words many times, because when I felt a bit down or listened to the commentary, don't watch the fight. I never watched the fight back. Never ever watched it back.
You've never watched it back.
But that commentary, it just, you know, it's a... I really thought those words, and then I beat the... So the reason why I was bitter, sorry. I beat the Dominican, my first fight. I beat the Ukrainian, my second fight. I beat the German, the third fight. Then in the semi-final, I boxed the Brazilian. The Dominican, Ukrainian, and German had all beaten the Brazilian that Olympic year. Within those 8 months, they'd all beaten him. The Ukrainian hit me so hard. I'd never been hit harder than that in my entire life. Never been hit as hard as that. And every punch I stood up to it and hit him back. The German, big, strong, really technical, very, very, very clever, very German, right? He was just crafty and good, knew what he was doing. He'd beaten Callum Smith 3 times. Callum Smith went on to win world titles as a pro. Unbelievable boxer. He beat him comfortably 3 times. I boxed his ears off. The semi-final, the Brazilian, he couldn't lace my gloves. And he beat me, and not just he beat me, I think he dropped me, I've never seen this, but I think he dropped me once or twice in the fight. And there's picturing type of him, yeah, and it's like, and when I do my inspirational talking, my motivational talking, I talk about at some point in life, you're going to get knocked down. You can be lying there looking up at the lights, and the referee's going to be counting 1, 2, 3. And it's about what you do in those moments will dictate what kind of person you are, or what kind of life you're going to lead. And I mean, I've been there. Semi-final Olympic Games. This guy who was the worst person I boxed, he beat me. And I talk about the business because it took me a long time to come to terms that he didn't really beat me. This isn't me having any sour grapes.
The circumstances
beat me. I was fucked. I had nothing. The 4 weeks of not training, the injections in the rib every couple of days in Olympics, like to numb the pain. The sneaking out of the village, being so drained, being so tired, that beat me. The Brazilian couldn't punch for shit. He was technical and he was crafty. The Ukrainian that I beat, he won the world championships by smack. I think he had 5, 6 fights, knocked out 5. he didn't knock out the Japanese guy in the final, but he smashed him to bits, like dropped him, like bullied him around and being like, mm-hmm. like he was his dad. The Japanese guy beat the Brazilian in the final. And it's like the Ukrainian was a much better version than the Japanese, big, fit and strong, but Ukrainian was way better. And like, I was the best person there in the weight category. And like, I should have won a gold, and people like Anthony Joshua won a gold medal, and I would deserve them more than him. And Luke Campbell won it. And I felt like I deserved more than him, and Nicola Adams. And I was like, I seen these guys getting all the success. And it's like the one thing I wanted. I remember Luke Campbell, and Luke's a really good friend of mine, right? I remember like, I'm very patriotic and like MBEs like mean shit to me. And I've always wanted it because Linda Christie won the gold medal. And that's what I've always wanted. And I could not wait to get my gold medal, get my MBE, go to Buckingham Palace, meet the Queen, get my MBE. And I remember Luke Campbell, we were talking after Olympics one time, and he was like, oh, go to London next week. I thought, I'll get my MBE. Didn't we know what an MBE was, right? He's not the player. Lovely lad, unbelievable fights, and not the sharpest tool in the toolbox. And I was like, you're complaining about spending 70 quid to go to London, mate. That's all I've ever wanted. And Josh talking about, he used to do this whole Nigerian thing where he was like, he used to feel like he was Nigerian. I'm being like, you're winning gold medal for Great Britain. You're living my dream. It's like, fuck, man. It's like, so I was really bitter for a long time and it took me a long time. So that's why it's hard, because I didn't get the result that I wanted, essentially. My dreams didn't come true.
Yeah.
Somebody else's did. It's taken me a while to get to a point where I can look back at my bronze medal now and go, do you know what? It wasn't the colour that I wanted, but I said this in my talk last week. I said, somebody asked me a question and it was like, would you change it for the gold medal? And an easy story, an easy ride. And it's taken me, I've gone from wanting a gold medal, I'd have stabbed somebody in the head for a gold medal. I go, what did that gold medal? Small than life itself. And somebody asked me a question. I've just done my talks. So I was a little bit like, I was, you know what it's like when you do talking, you feel a little bit buzzy or whatever.
Well, the adrenaline's there.
Adrenaline. And I said, I don't know if I would. Like, my story is my gold medal. Like, that means so much to me that I came through and I wanted to quit. I think the Brazilian dropped me the second time in the fight and I had nothing left. I knew I wasn't going to win. And I wanted to stay, and the referee was counting me out, and I wanted to stay down because I knew I wasn't going to win. I had nothing left in me. And everyone who knew my story, nobody would have begrudged me staying down. And I thought, my mum's in hospital fighting for her life. I thought, I can't stay down. That's no son of hers. I can't. And I got up and I punched and I punched and I punched the final bell. I knew I wasn't going to win. I was weak as a kitten. I couldn't knock him out. I had to knock him out to win. I couldn't get the point back, but I tried. And I'm really proud of that. So is my proudest achievement? I guess beating a Ukrainian is the actual isolated moment, my being my proudest achievement. And she was in a coma still when I came back. And, you know, weeks later, months later, actually, when she was kind of like up and in a wheelchair, I took a medal to go and see her. And I've got a lovely picture of her, like, sitting in the chair. Like, she won't remember the picture, but I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
You know, so, whew, you talk now.
So, full circle for those people who obviously don't know the story. You need to put some closure there. That mum is still here.
Yes. I mentioned her earlier, like I was a little boy. I'm still a little boy. She's still here. She's my hero. Like she still survived. She's, you know, when you don't really recover from a brain aneurysm, recovery is a constant recovery.
Yeah.
Survived. But I'm so proud of her. She is, you know, she's mum. I call her Tessie. I don't call her mum. My nan, I used to call her Janet, not my nan. I don't know why, but I call my nan Janet. My mum Tessie, Teresa. And yeah, she's as strong as an ox, Tessie. She's a wonderful person.
So again, there's tons in there. I'm not going to unpack loads of that because you're going to shout at me if I do. One thing that you mentioned all throughout it is, you know, you're talking about the need to win and the bitterness there. Do you think that bitterness has fueled you to still want to be the best? I know you said you're working on not necessarily needing to be the best at everything, but do you think that kind of, that whatever emotion it was, anger, frustration, you know, the annoyance that you didn't get what you believed you earned, do you think that's driven you in other areas of your life?
Initially, I am now a professional wrestler. in the US. It's fun. It's good. I really enjoy it. It ticks a lot of boxes. The boxing ticked. Doesn't take all of them. It can't. It's a different industry. And I went into wrestling wanting to make up for what I didn't do in boxing. But I can't. It's just a different sport. It's not down to you. It's more theatre than boxing. So it's like I went into that industry with the wrong mindset, wanting to be the best. You can't be the best in a sport where you can't be the best. You can't be the world champ. Isn't the world champ? The world champ is world champ because he's not the best. I mean, it's hard to explain. Yes, politics and stuff, and I struggle with that side of things. I struggle with, like, I've always lived my life. We had, even since the swimming days, like going swimming before school. Like, if you work hard, you win races. If you work hard at boxing, you win. You win fights. It's not the same in this industry because it's not true sport, unfortunately. So, I think I'd. That's a really good question, Tony. I need to think about it, and we haven't got long enough to really think about it. But being the best, I don't sound really cheesy. I want to be the best me now, and that's not
cheesy.
Like, it is a bit cheesy, but I want to be the best version of myself. I want to be a good person. I want to make people proud of me. I haven't always done things make people like close to me proud. I want to be a good person and be the best person I can be. So I had to retire from boxing with an eye injury. 78% blind on my left eye. I can't do a lot. Earlier, I dropped the bag in the left eye, like some pasta stain on the floor. I'm sorry, mate. Sorry.
Sorry, James.
Yikes. Because I'm clumsy and I knock things over now because I haven't got no depth perception. I don't understand. I've lost a lot of, I've got a depth perception. Can't think of the word now because I've been talking too much. But I'm a bit clumsy. Like, I knock things over because I can't see things recently enough. So I could never go back and do a real sport because most of the time you need two eyes to do a good sport. So I don't know, really. I'm still trying to find myself. I still feel, actually, putting it back onto you, we've only known each other for 74 days.
Love the fact that you didn't count up before the podcast.
But I didn't do it day by day. I did it. It's 10 weeks and 4 days.
That's all right. You can keep marking them down on a daily basis. I've known for 75 days now.
I'm going to be nice to you now. I'm not going to say it. But, like, you've really inspired me in my life. You really have inspired me a lot. And I feel a lot clearer now. So what I was going to say is I feel like I've known you for way longer. I can't imagine not knowing you now. That's because of the loud voice. Or the
you mean yours?
Yeah, funny. You've really helped. You've helped inspire me to do different things. You really, really have. I mean this wholeheartedly. And I've been really lost since boxing the last 4 years. I've felt lost. I thought I was going to get what I was looking for from wrestling. It can't do it for me in the same way boxing did. So I've got to look at that differently now.
Yeah.
Which I'm beginning to do. And now if I look at it differently, I can now enjoy it more because I'm looking at it as like it's boxing. It can't ever be boxing. So I can't look at it and treat it like it's boxing.
Can't compare apples and pears.
You cannot. So I'm now looking at it as a pear or an apple.
Whichever you choose. I'm going to play devil's advocate here and say, because you've had like the shit that happened, like what are the odds of your mum's aneurysm, which is a ticking time bomb. If it was going to happen, it happened at any point. What are the odds of that happening at that point in time? You can either be bitter by that or you can kind of say, you know, it happened for a reason. If people say you were plagued by injuries during your career, you know, as you say, you had 2 years out due to Achilles problems, your entire career ended with, as your talk says, just one punch. And it was, you know, prior to that, you'd had such a successful career and continue to do so because people measure it really, you know, my feelings around success. Mm. People measure it by, you know, the number of things that are chalked up as a win when if we're playing devil's advocate, what if all of that happened in the way that it did so that you could be the person that you are now, inspiring other people so that shit all happened? Because what about the people who are the year of 2012 or name your year when something bad's happened? Do you now use that to fuel you? What's next for you?
What's next? Yeah, I went to a boxing show. So I was with Wasserman Boxing. That was my, well, Waterman Box are now one of the biggest promoters in the world. They bought Sauerland. Sauerland were one of the biggest promoters in the world.
Yeah, but they weren't back then.
When I was with Wasserman, I was the Wasserman division. I joined my agent, Dean Baker, who's a tremendous, fantastic, brilliant man. Me and Dean Baker and Duncan Ross, we created Wasserman Boxing. I took a huge leap of faith going with Dean, and they took a leap of faith being with me. Rather than going down the traditional route with another manager, I went with them. And I was the Wasserman Boxing division for 3 years. Then with my success in and out the ring, we signed George Groves and one or two other people. And now Wasserman kind of grew from being a boxing manager to now a massive promoter. They bought Sauerland. And I went to the first Wasserman show at the O2 like a couple of years ago. And I was there. And people didn't really recognize me. And that was weird. And then there's lads who kind of looked at me. He's like, he's one of the Wasserman boxes. He's like, are you on New Go-Go? I said, yeah. He said, oh, what are you doing here? I thought, mate, like, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be here.
And I wasn't.
What are you doing here? Like, what are you? And I was like, I don't even know what point I'm trying to make at this point, but it's hard because I wanted a better point. I'm gonna make a better point. When I retired, I did the rounds and spoke to this person, that person. I kept getting asked, like, how do you want to be remembered? And don't get me wrong, I just retired from boxing. I've been a boxer for 18 years. That was my identity. I just lost it unwillingly. I didn't want to. And plus my vision in my eye. And I was really bitter about everything. And they said to me, like, how do you want to be remembered in boxing? And I said, I won't be. I haven't done enough to be remembered. I didn't do enough because of my injuries and stuff. And what another thing that annoys me is people can go, he was decent. Are you like injured a lot? Yeah, he's all right. And people can only make assumptions off what they see. Most assumptions they make were Olympic Games. That's what I'm most known for. You heard my Olympic story. I was a shell of me. I was a shell. People would have watched the semi-final against the Brazilian when I got dropped. Someone said to me, I heard from I'm not going to say the name because, you know, a very reputable boxing coach, when asked about me, he went, he's all right, but he's got no chin. Seeing me got dropped in the semi-final Olympic Games, didn't know the story. Didn't see the fight before, two fights before, when I stood up to the hardest punching man I've ever boxed against, every punch, and fired back when I was running on fumes. They saw, people make a judgment of what they see. That's all people can do. In the pros, what I went through, you think the Olympic journey was difficult? Jesus, you cannot believe my pro story. You cannot believe it. Some of the stuff I went through and had to kind of, you know, the bad luck I had. So I was never really 100% fit a few times, but they were undercard fights. People didn't really see what I could have done.
Didn't get to showcase.
And that's an annoying thing. No one got to see how good I could have been. Like, I'm left-handed. I should have been a southpaw. When I hurt my eye, I trained for 3 years. I went from East Essex to West London every single day to train a new coach I had. And I'm left-handed. He said, well, let's make you southpaw. So for 2.5 years, I trained as a southpaw. I would have been unbelievable. No one got to see how good I could have been. Mm-hmm. That's a really annoying thing. No one got to see all my hard work. And I showed such strength of character and such bravery, having about 10 operations on my eye now, 9 in 2.5 years to get back in the ring. I couldn't get back in the ring. I had one last month because it still plagues me. The problem's still there. And I needed to lift my eyelids so I can see more looking up. I showed my bravery on operating tables, in physio beds. I didn't get to show it in the ring. So no one got to see how good I was, how talented I was, how tough I was as an individual. That's quite frustrating. So I guess I'm using that disappointment. What's next for me? I don't know. I do know what's next for me, actually. And there's a large thank you goes to you. I am creating the best fitness app in the world. A Go-Go Fitness, Be the Revolution.
Future legend.
Future legend, right? The 2020s Mr. Motivator.
Can we?
Little spandex.
Oh, God.
Oh, guess what?
I'm a visual person and that's not a good image.
Guess what? My mum loved him as well. My mum loved him. My mum fancied him. But in all seriousness, like, you've really inspired me, and I've hinted at it. You have helped me kind of get my idea down. A Go-Go Fitness, as I said, I want to be a legend. I've always wanted to be a legend as a kid. I thought boxing was going to be the thing to get me there. It didn't. I thought wrestling was. It may still well be, but maybe not because of just of stuff and that. I feel like I have greatness inside me that I want to get out. And like you mentioned a minute ago, I mean, there's a quote from Audrey Hepburn. She got about 30 and she realized she had two hands. One hand to help herself and one hand to help others. I'm at that stage in my life right now. I want to help people and use my... Another thank you for you as well, Tony. Like, two thank yous. You've really empowered me with public speaking, because you've empowered me that my story alone can help people, because that's my story. I've lived it. Ain't that big deal to me. Like, it's just my life. I've done it. It wasn't until you spoke to me and said to me, no, you telling your story, you just telling your story alone can help people. That's really empowering. And also recently, and I thank you for, you've believed in me when I was beginning to lose belief in myself. And without belief, you don't do anything in life. So thank you for that. And you've believed in me to realize that I can create the best fitness app in the world, a go-go fitness, be the revolution.
There you can.
So get involved in that, people. And yeah, take control of your life. Within as little as 7 minutes a day, become the best version of yourself.
Oh, so that's a kind of watch this space, because that's under construction at the minute.
Come in.
I'm like conscious of time. So I'm going to do. So don't worry, it's fine. Don't worry about it. We're fine. There's one question I always ask guests and always will, and it is, what is the one subject that no one ever asks you about, or what is the one question that no one ever asks you but you want someone to ask?
Good question.
Why, thank you.
I'm like you, I'm quite an open book. And also, I've got a really bad memory, so...
Dory fish.
Dory fish. So I've probably been asked questions I've just forgotten. I don't know. I don't know. I don't... And also, I don't need... Because normally, if someone asks you a question that you want to answer because you want to brag about something, right? I don't need an invite to be bragged. I brag about myself. I don't need an invite to brag myself.
Does it need to be about the bragging? What's the one subject that no one ever asks you about? Because it's, you know, the hobby that you've got, or the guilty pleasure, or the type that, you know, the movie that you watch that no one ever knows that you're into that genre of movie. There's got to be something. And if you don't know the answer now, that is the invitation to the next episode of the podcast that I will interview you for, because we have barely scratched the surface.
A
million and five questions written down that I hadn't even, we haven't even touched upon Bear Grylls, Strictly, Splash, which we were at an event and it was the funniest thing ever. So this is like quite a poignant thing to leave it on. We were at an event, the first time that I've met you, and you said people don't remember you. Me and Ben stood at the back of the room and I was like, yeah, we were in the conference. Because you look very different. There's a question I have to ask you from quiz as well, which we'll come to in a second. And it was like, yeah, so people do. And it was like, yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. So we knew who you were. There were a couple of people in the room who were like, who's that? Who's that? We're taking the mickey out of you, because that's my specialism. And we were talking about, someone mentioned Strictly, and then we talked about the different TV programs you were at. And I don't know if you remember, but Claire was sat at the back of the room. She had her laptop on with the sound. And as soon as she played a video, the look, everyone turned around and looked. So Splash, there's Big Brother. There's so many different things that we need to discuss. So that's like a podcast to be continued. Yeah. But there is one question, because I always ask Chris, give me a rogue or an out there question. And he said, the difference between you and your boxing career, you talked about, you know, walking around to 75 kilos, looking very different. What's the difference in your training regime now and what you eat?
Oh, wow. It's night and day. Good question, Chris. It's night and day. Basically, as a boxer, everything was cardio and a lot in. So as a pro, I boxed 72.5 kilos, 11 stone 6, which is tiny, tiny, tiny.
Tiny feet.
I was like 5.5 stone. I'm about 16.5 stone at the moment. It's about 5 stone lighter than I am now. As a boxer, everything was cardio. Everything. I often train really hard in the morning. 3 hours I'd do. Goodness me, looking back now, I've got to keep the most comprehensive training diary on my phone. So I often look back and see what I do and go, goodness me, how are they doing that?
How did they do it? Yeah.
I feel sick just looking at it. I'd train for 3 hours, and then I'd drive to Hammersmith and train for 3 hours, and then I'd stay over the night, train 3 hours in the boxing gym, drive home, and the evening on the second day would be a bit lighter, an hour and a half, 2 hours, but
a bit lighter.
But it'd be like, yeah, I mean, yeah, I used to do, as a boxer, it was in the morning strength and conditioning, and then making weight, always making weight. So I'd do 2 hours strength and conditioning, or an hour, half. And because I'm a lot of injuries, I take a long time to warm up. So half an hour warm up, hour and a half session in the weight gym room, And then I'll say an hour and a half, so it's 2 hours. Then I'll do like about 45 minutes on the cross trainer, then a stretch. That's 3 hours. Have some food. Oftentimes the only thing I'd eat that day, bowl of porridge with some with protein in it, banana, or porridge and a protein shake, whatever I felt more like filled up by. Drive to Hammersmith, train, protein shake, go to bed. Wake up, boxing training, 3 hours. And again, there's warm up in there, there's a cool down in there. There's a stretch in there. I'd always do minimum 20 rounds of punching, which is an hour of punching. So like 20 rounds could be six shadow, 12 bag, four heavy bag, 12 pads, four heavy bag. But always an hour of punching, then often like a circuit at the end and a stretch and some flexibility stuff. Then home, then on the Tuesday, so that's Monday, that's the Monday. Then the Tuesday, wake up there, train there, come back. And the Tuesday night would be a cardio session. So a cardio would be, because I had bad Achilles, I didn't run as much. I do a lot of rowing machine, the VersaClimber, the bike. The occasion, I'd usually run once a week. So I have to kind of spend some time on your feet. Yeah, so Monday, Wednesday, Friday were the same, and Tuesday, Thursday were the same. Or if I was tired by Friday, which I often was.
Understandably.
I'd do my Saturday morning session on the Friday on a Saturday morning session. That's usually the one track session I'd do. So yeah, very hard. Versus now as a professional wrestler, wrestling's weird. Wrestling's a really weird industry. It's got to be looked at as an industry rather than a sport. So the first 2-3 years, I trained all the time. I trained, well, because wrestling's so hard, physically very hard. For example, right, last night I trained and I was doing... this isn't funny at all. It's actually really quite sad. I was doing Hurricane Ranas. What's Hurricane Rana, you say? How do you know what Hurricane Rana is? Hurricane Rana is basically, so I was working with a guy called Sam, real nice lad, real nice lad. Probably about 85 kilo, maybe 13 stone. I'm 16 and a half. Basically, Hurricane Rana is, okay, so visualize this. I'm standing up. I'm 6'2". Let's say, do it to him first. I'm 6'2". He jumps, facing each other. He jumps and I help him up, put a little bit, pop him up, yeah. And his cock is in my face. Right? It's the best day of my life. He dicks in my face.
That's why you do
that. That's why I just love wrestling. I just love wrestling. That's why I just can't give up. Dicks in my face. Obviously, he's got trousers on, frustratingly. and he's got a leg over my shoulder. So I'm here, like in a powerbomb position. So powerbomb as well. I've got him here and I slam him down to the floor. Hurricane Ron is where he jumps up and I pop him up a little bit here, legs over me, and he goes all the way back, if you can visualize it. Yep. So you see, he goes all the way back, he's upside down, and then I jump over and he kind of gets me in the pin. So now he's pinned me down, I'm on the floor and he's pinning me down. Makes sense? That's Hurricane Ron. We were doing that. I'm a big dude. I don't do Hurricane Ron. That's more like high flying, the smaller stuff. It's good to learn. If I can do Hurricane Ron and pull out one big match, people are going to go, fuck, that guy.
Wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, exactly. And Tom, who's a fantastic coach, he was like, man, you got to do this. Oh, and Sam is a strong boy, to be fair. He's a strong lad. So I was in Hurricane Runners last night. I was jumping up, landed on his again.
Rolls reversed.
All dick in face, right? And doing it. So the reason why wrestling is very, very hard, and it's hard to compare apples and pears. We did it all night. 2 hour session, we were doing Hurricane Runners, jumping on his, he's catching me. The last one we were going to film, because the last one of the night we're going to film, I filmed his, I'll post it tonight probably or soon. And then he did mine. I've jumped, we've done it probably 30 times. I jumped up on him. I guess he was a little bit tired. I came in high. You may have like a staggered foot, especially when you're not the bigger man. So if they come in a little bit hot, they can go and put the weight on the back foot. Yep. He was square. He staggered back. He fell down. I've smashed my head into the rope, which is really dangerous because you can kind of give yourself a concussion. All my weight landed on his knee. Luckily, his knee was just been flat. If his knee wasn't flat on the ring, ACL, meniscus done, probably never wrestle again. Luckily, his leg was just on the floor and I landed on it. And I think he's got like a deep like contusion because a 105 kilo dude land on your leg is going to hurt. He hasn't texted me yet to see how bad it is. Point I'm making is wrestling's very dangerous. Anything can go wrong. You can break your finger to break your neck. And all it takes is one lapse of concentration, being a bit too sweaty, slipping. You've got to look after yourself and the person you're wrestling with. Like your job is to keep him safe and vice versa.
Yeah.
So the point I'm making is, you don't. So the first two or three years, I trained all the time, but you just can't train that much because it just hurts. Mm. It's really hurt. So I spend a lot of time in the gym, lifting weights, making sure I look good because wrestling's really vain, vanity sport.
Which
industry.
You obviously love.
I hate it, Tony. So
you just take one for the team.
Do you know what? If I have to, what? Baby oil? Go on then. But yeah, so the training's very different. Basically, in short, boxer, loads of cardio, not a lot of food. As a wrestler, loads of food, no cardio, and loads of lifting weights.
So, we're going to finish with one final question, because you are launching your own podcast. Who's your ideal podcast guest and why?
Well, obviously the fabulous Tony Gargan.
See, we need none of that shit. Tell the truth.
Okay. No, wow, good question. So my podcast called Getting Back Up with me, Anthony Ogogo, where I talk to people, inspiring people with amazing stories that have achieved something great in their lives but only after suffering massive setback. Because like my career, I did this for a few reasons. One, to help people.
Yeah.
One, and to help me, one, to help others. And to inspire people going through their own tough times. And also for me, to heal. Because I'm not fully healed yet. Mm-hmm. And we had Nikki on your course last month. And Nikki, I'm not going to go into her story, but basically she's got a really heartbreaking story where she lost members of her family for something really difficult. And she's at a place in her life now where she's obviously heartbroken by it, but she's okay. She's made peace. She can smile and have a good day. Yeah. And that happened to me, losing my sister and my niece or nephew. That consumes me. I never get out of that hole. I'm finding it hard to get out of this boxing hole I plummeted into. And I want to learn from how other people have healed from their own traumas, and not just healed from the trauma, use that setback and make it the best thing that's ever happened to them. Mm-hmm. So I talk to those types of people. It's a very inspiring podcast, Getting Back Up with me, Anthony Ogogo. And who's an ideal guest? Do you know what? Anybody, another quick story. I'll make it quick, I promise you.
It's all right. Make it a good one. It's going to be the last one.
It won't be quick. So I've spoken to boxers like George Groves, who won the world title in his fourth attempt, never gave up after getting knocked out in two badly in two very, very big occasions. Rugby player who played for England, played for the Lions, had to retire after because of injury, came back, created an amazing career for himself in America as the lead analyst in a big TV show, got testicular cancer. Lost his bollocks, literally. Came back, living his best life. Amazing partner, nice house in San Francisco. A true comeback story.
Yeah.
For me, the best stories are the human people.
I'm so glad they're humans.
It's the human element of normal people. For example, a friend of mine, Hayden Walden, who's an absolute legend. He had a child. Him and his wife had a child. He was stillborn. Heartbreaking. They ran off to America to escape their lives in England. I met them in America. There were English people abroad. We hang out, we get together. We were, like, me, Hayden, his lovely, beautiful wife, Laura, became really, really friendly. After a couple of years in America, Laura got breast cancer. So because they didn't have the health insurance, they came back to the NHS and got treatment here. The NHS, there's stories like this on my podcast. NHS, they were given an examination and they were like, oh, you know, the cancer did X, Y, Z. So do you know that you're pregnant? So she had no idea she was pregnant. Missed a couple of periods because of the stress and stuff. She was pregnant. They ran the chemo and the pregnancy alongside each other. When she gave birth to Maisie, beautiful little baby girl, she was in remission. The baby that was stillborn, I'm sorry, Hayden, I've forgotten the first girl's name, had a heart defect, and they were testing Maisie along the pregnancy to see if she had it. She didn't have it. She was born. A few days later after being born, I kept in hospital because she had other things going on. Something bad happened and she got taken away from them. They were obviously panicking, and they brought her back a few hours later and they said, oh, she's okay. Her heart stopped in that period. They didn't know this at the time. This came to fruition later. They resussed her and then she's really, really poorly. You know, days go by and then Maisie unfortunately dies also. So Hayden and his lovely wife Laura had birth to stillborn and lost their baby Maisie. Two horrendous pregnancies. Within weeks, Laura's cancer comes back.
Oh.
and she dies months later. My mate Hayden, again, Tingle's talking about it. My mate Hayden lost two girls and two angels in heaven, and now his wife's in heaven. And he's lonely. He's on his own. And it's just me. I'm out. I'm gone. See you later, world. I'm off. I'm not coming back from that. He was almost there. And his comeback story is he found love again. He's now, and I've forgotten his wife's name, and I apologize, Hayden. He's happy again. He's now an extremely proud stepfather to her four or five kids, and they're really happy. That is what my podcast is all about. Never giving up. Never giving up, because better days are around the corner. Please never give up. Getting back up. That's what getting back up is all about. So I've been very lucky to be around like a lot of celebrities in my life, since the Olympics, last 10, 11 years. A lot of athletes, people that won gold medals, Olympics and world titles and earn lots of money. That's great. That's amazing. That's really inspiring. But talking to everyday people, that's what gets my dick hard. That's what excites me.
Charming.
There you go. I am quite the wordsmith, as you can tell. But that's what really excites me, genuinely. Like hearing everyday stories, inspiring stories from normal people that refuse to give up. Now, I can get behind that. That I knew Hayden's story. We were texting. I was his friend going through this. I cried three times hearing him tell his story, and I knew what was coming.
Yeah.
And to see him happy and smiling and being so proud of himself and of his wife and of his new family, man, that's what it's all about to me. So bringing those stories to life. But to answer your question, Will Smith.
Duly noted. We'll see what we can do. Thanks so much. I'm conscious of time. We're like way over time, but I'm going to ask you now, because if I ask you on this, then you can't say no. Are you going to come back and do round two where I can ask all of the questions that I'd actually prepared?
Yeah, I think I will.
Yes, there was no question there. It was a statement.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
Thank you very much.